It's always pleasing when an LSE audience becomes suddenly very quiet in expectation of the introduction and the lecture, so thank you for your politeness. Distinguished guests, Your Excellency, I'm delighted, ladies and gentlemen, delighted to welcome each of you to tonight's lecture. This is, of course, one in a series of lectures and public events organized by the Hellenic Observatory, which is part of the European Institute here at the LSE. And we're delighted this evening to welcome back Haris Yoyadis. Haris, as you well know, is the Minister of Finance of the Republic of Cyprus, and he has held that position for now almost 4 years. As Minister of Finance, he's led for Cyprus in the Eurozone institutions. He's been at the center of the bailout program for Cyprus, of course, but he's also gained a wider international profile. He is chairman of the board of directors of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. He's a member of the board of governors of the IMF, of the European Investment Bank, and the European Stability Mechanism. Of course, the recent performance of the Cyprus economy has attracted a lot of international attention. A year ago, Cyprus was able to exit its bailout program. Jeroen Dijsselbloem, the head of the Eurogroup, declared, "Cyprus can now fund itself, and many of the fiscal, financial, and structural reforms undertaken have put Cyprus back on the path of sustainable growth. Overall, the Cypriot authorities have delivered a very, very good job." It sounds like an LSE essay comment. But whilst we are in such language, we should also note that Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, has said that the Cypriot program had delivered, quote, an impressive turnaround of the economy during the past 3 years. So we're interested to hear about how this has been done. We're interested to hear about the success of the program. How has this happened? How can we measure that success? What have been the major impediments? The contrast, sadly, with Greece is obviously rather too clear. In any event, few people are better placed to explain the performance of the Cyprus economy and the government policy than, of course, the Minister of Finance. We will ensure that at the end of his presentation there is plenty of time for questions and answers, comments from you. But we look forward to the presentation, and can you please join me in welcoming the Minister of Finance for the Republic of Cyprus, Haris Yoyadis.
Thank you very much, Professor, ladies and gentlemen. Before anything else, let me say that I'm truly honored to be at the LSE and to have the opportunity to address to address this audience. Thank you to the Hellenic Observatory for hosting this lecture, and thank you all for attending. I will attempt to share a few thoughts on economic policy, drawing from the recent experiences of Cyprus and reflecting also on a broader European dimension. So let me remind you that 4 years ago, Cyprus made the world headlines for all the wrong reasons when it was engulfed in an unprecedented economic and financial crisis. Actually, Cyprus was in a critical situation at least 2 years earlier, when, after years of excessive deficit spending and also facing the likelihood of bank recapitalization, it lost access to the international capital markets. In short, it was unable to finance its needs. The government of the day did not immediately seek a support program, choosing instead to raise taxes and to draw on domestic liquidity. Our economy slid into recession and unemployment rose steeply long before the Troika was ever invited. By March 2013, the public coffers were literally empty, with cash reserves sufficing for a month. And to make things worse, there was a massive flight on bank deposits, which eventually led to the collapse of a major systemic bank and the first ever use of the bail-in instrument, with a loss for bank depositors and the inevitable imposition of capital controls. The Cyprus economy was led into a perfect storm. As a banker has said, it had sustained a near-fatal heart attack. Confidence had reached rock bottom, and participation in the Eurozone, even in the EU itself, was being questioned. Under such dire circumstances, the terms of an ESM IMF support program were swiftly concluded. So, ladies and gentlemen, 4 years on, I can speak of a remarkable recovery. Cyprus remains firmly within the Eurozone. We have successfully completed the support program in time, having re-established sustainable access to the international capital markets. The banking sector has stabilized and healed to a significant extent, though challenges remain. Our people have suffered, but were not led into despair. Unemployment is still high, but is declining. And more than anything, we did not remain trapped in a vicious cycle of austerity and recession, as the doomsayers were predicting. In fact, our economy edged out of recession in 2015 and is currently registering a growth rate of 3% of the GDP, which is almost twice the Eurozone average. Cyprus has essentially secured a second chance, and it is from this vantage point that one can attempt to draw a few policy lessons and conclusions. So the first point I want to make is that postponing difficult but necessary decisions in economic policy is a recipe for disaster. Hiding the problems under the carpet does not make them go away. It only makes the day of reckoning more difficult. We were led to take action, and this made things worse, as the people of Cyprus have painfully learned. Nor is it possible to evade reality forever, hiding behind sensational but meaningless rhetoric. On the other hand, doing the job as quickly as possible and as effectively as possible can be crucial in restoring economic confidence. And confidence is, of course, the single most important ingredient to a successful economic recovery. Secondly, continuously raising public expenditure and running excessive deficits does not offer a sustainable path to economic recovery and growth. Creating an overextended civil service and maintaining, for instance, a welfare system whose expenses can only go up but never down are not policies which actually enhance social cohesion. On the contrary, these are policies which will eventually create an impossible burden on the productive forces of an economy, placing social cohesion at risk. In this direction, and over a 4-year period, we managed to bring the public sector payroll down by 21.5% and the number of civil servants down by 8%, not through redundancies, of course, but by imposing a very strict freeze on new hiring, allowing only a few exemptions. Recently, we have actually proposed to our parliament that this policy regarding new public sector hiring and the freeze is extended indefinitely. We have also completely reformed the welfare system, introducing a guaranteed minimum income for everyone, but at the same time establishing credible eligibility criteria and control mechanisms. Point number three, raising taxes during a downturn will only make a recession more likely and more severe. Raising taxes is actually the worst kind of austerity imposed on households and business by governments which are not able or willing to put their own house in order and lack the appetite to promote structural reform. On this, let me tell you that we have implemented a fully fledged Troika program without raising a single tax. On the contrary, we have been introducing tax breaks and incentives cautiously at the beginning, more forcefully of late. Among others, we have introduced targeted tax breaks for the injection of new equity in any company, an ambitious tax relief for investment in startups and innovative companies, and we reversed and cancelled taxes on labor and property which were imposed during the years of the deficit spending. Unsurprisingly, what has been confirmed by the Cyprus example is that if done correctly, lowering tax rates will not actually reduce public revenues, since the revival of economic activity will more than cover for any shortfalls. A related point is that the balanced budget is not austerity. It is common sense. First of all, a balanced budget means that the government will spend everything it earns. This is hardly an austere approach, unless we have all become so much accustomed to our government spending systematically more than they bring in as revenue. One of the most deliberate objectives of our economic policy was to balance the budget fast, and we did so in one go, eliminating a public deficit which was persistently at a level of 5 to 6% of the GDP to practically zero over a single year in 2014, and keeping it steady ever since. As I have mentioned, this was done not by raising taxes, but through spending cuts to the extent that it was necessary. This is exactly what enabled us to fend off pressures on behalf of the Troika for additional fiscal measures, which I can tell you were almost continuous. It also enabled us to maintain tax stability and to promote tax breaks, and this in turn did wonders in restoring consumer and business confidence. And essentially, this got the economy moving again. At this point, I should mention that the state of the banking sector is equally important for the revival and growth of an economy. Our banking sector has undergone an almost complete transformation. It is now smaller in size, but healthier. And it goes without saying that the banking sector should lend responsibly, always evaluating the ability of the borrower to repay, channeling financing not so much towards consumption, but primarily towards investment on the basis of sound business plans. Common sense again, you will you will tell me. But this, I'm afraid, was not at all the case during the previous decade of irrational exuberance and the unsustainable credit expansion which fueled the property bubble and led to the overheating of our economy. Ladies and gentlemen, we have come a long way. But let me be clear, there is still more which needs to be done. Challenges remain, and the temptation to go back to the false policies of the past persists. And this brings me to what I consider as probably the most important point of all. Populism has never and will never offer a way forward. But if unchecked, it could jeopardize everything that we have worked for. How regrettable it is for the Hellenic world throughout its modern history to have always been so receptive to the populist chants, despite the fact that on all occasions their flirtations with populism have ended in tears and hardship. And how regrettable it is that we, the contemporary Greeks, seldom employ rational thinking and logic which were pioneered by our very own ancestors. Populism is on the rise. In fact, today, populism is threatening much more than the hard-won recovery of the small economy of Cyprus. It's posing a threat to the European Union, a threat to the liberal world order, and a threat to democracy. Across our continent, we are facing the rise of an irrational, demagogic, Eurosceptic, anti-liberal populism. The populist challenge comes both from the extreme right and the extreme left, as its proponents attempt to tap into those segments of the population who feel that they have been left behind. Protectionism seems to be the common ground. So we must respond, and we must do so in the only way that anyone can fend off the demagogues and the populists, by telling the truth and by making an effective and enlightened case in favor of the flow of goods, ideas, capital, and people as essential elements for prosperity. But at the same time, we should be ready to acknowledge the faults of the European integration process. The narrow technocratic politics obsessed by process has reached its limits. I consider myself pro-European, but I'm becoming increasingly concerned by the institutional dynamics which continuously push for more bureaucracy and more regulation. Having faced the shock of the Brexit vote, I believe we should pause and reflect before making another step in the European integration process. And if we do so, we may actually recall that originally the European community was about freedom, freedom of movement of goods, freedom of movement of services, freedom of movement of capital, freedom of movement of people. The European ideal was about freedom and the elimination of restrictive rules and regulations meant to encourage economic growth and prosperity. But over the years, an invisible hand has been swamping economic sectors with overregulation. The prudent principle of subsidiarity has been giving ground to centralization I fear that another mistaken step, for instance, in the direction of establishing a European tax, may prove fatal. I am of the view that any further steps in the European integration process, and especially any new steps in European economic policy, must be well thought, cautious, and should strive to make our economies more efficient, competitive, adaptive, and less bureaucratic. These steps should happen through a transparent political process with unquestionable democratic legitimacy. The perception of decisions and guidelines emerging through obscure processes, even though exaggerated, should be tackled. This is the only way we shall be able to reconnect with the people. Ladies and gentlemen, I will conclude by saying that the European Union should probably do less, but it should do it better. It must refocus on its essential core tasks of creating conditions which will promote economic growth, innovation, and enterprise, which will create jobs and opportunities, and will result in the sustainable prosperity of our people and the cohesion of our societies. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Minister, very much indeed. We've hosted a number of lectures, of course, over the years, and let me say that I found that exceptionally clear and with a strong argument. So there's plenty of things for people to discuss. So I thank you for the clarity of your thought and your very clear, strong argument. Could I begin by perhaps just picking up a couple of points that you made? Of course, we were left to wonder which countries you might have in mind when you were talking about... I made a note here about excessive exuberance, populism, etc. But others may pursue that question. My question more is that when I heard you talking about the correct economic recipe, it seemed to be very ordo-liberal. Are you an ordo-liberal?
A what liberal?
Ordo-liberal. Wolfgang Schäuble's.
Okay, yes. All right, okay.
Everything you were saying in terms of we should cut expenditure, there were certain disciplines throughout the economic cycle.
Well, first of all, I was referring to Cyprus of the previous decade. We were doing...
The comparison with Athens never entered your mind when you were making these points.
Well, we tend to emulate, but not on the good things. So, yes, I mean, I can probably answer the second part of your question by explaining what I meant, the period of irrational exuberance of the previous decade. We were spending more than we were earning. The public sector was doing so. The private sector was doing so, leading to an excessive private indebtedness also. Well, that's not a sustainable path to economic growth. It's good while it lasts, but it will, as it had, ended in misery and disaster. So, I'm not sure what etiquette you will choose to use on this approach that I have been trying to promote and to implement during the last 4 years, but I think I am a liberal, but I think that if there's a if there's a characteristic about it, it's common sense liberalism, because that's what it is. We should not, we cannot sustainably spend more than we earn. We cannot do so if we are a household or if we are a family business, and we can definitely not do so if we're an economy. That has been the approach, and I think we have tangibly shown that rectifying this imbalance actually works and can bring an economy back on growth.
Okay, but it just struck me that from what you were arguing, that the recipe that the Eurozone has given to the various bailout states, from what you say logically, was a correct diagnosis and a correct set of solutions. So what the Eurozone has asked of Cyprus, what the Eurozone has asked of the other bailout states, the Eurozone has got it right.
Well, yes and the no. Obviously, to a very significant extent, what the programs included were the basic necessary reforms that our economies needed in any case. So in that sense, I would agree. But I did emphasize the very deliberate prioritization of our economic policy to balance the budget so as to remove any grounds for the Troika to insist that we should keep taking fiscal measures, keep adopting spending cuts, and keep imposing taxes, which is, I fear, a policy characteristic of support programs, which does not find me in agreement. But the only way that a country can avoid finding itself in such a difficult situation and being asked continuously to take fiscal measures in a manner which wrecks any remaining confidence in an economy is to do the job quickly, to remove any pretext, and to be able to move ahead.
Thank you. Obviously, some argue that the very structure of the Eurozone has inbuilt imbalances, structural inequalities and imbalances, which disadvantage the periphery. Some argue that one way forward for the Eurozone in the future would be what you have rejected, that is, some elements of European taxation. Some would argue that there should be a common unemployment benefit across the Eurozone. We've heard arguments for a stronger fiscal competence at the European level to tax, but also in terms of an equalization, as it were, of social benefits, unemployment benefits, precisely to help the periphery. You seem to be arguing not necessary, not desirable.
Such propositions would have the exact opposite effect. If there is an imbalance, it's one of productivity and competitiveness, and you will not eliminate the gaps in productivity and competitiveness by imposing a uniform minimum tax across the EU, or by raising, for instance, welfare spending or establishing unemployment schemes across the Europe. I think that would not only further widen the imbalances, but I think that would spell the end of the European Union. What we should do is the exact opposite. Facilitate competition, including tax competition. That's the only way that will ensure that we shall have a low tax economy or low tax economies in our continent, to promote structural reform in order to make all economies, including the economies of the South, productive and competitive, and that's the prerequisite for sustainable growth, but also the prerequisite for strengthening the Eurozone.
Thank you very much indeed. Let me now open it up to comments and questions from the audience. We have colleagues with a microphone. Could you please simply identify who you are and then proceed to your questions? Could we take the gentleman here first of all, please? Can we take, say, three at a time?
Yes, of course. Yes.
It's Luis Loise from the Hellenic Bank Association and Petrico Capital. A comment from the minister on the privatization program and whether the government has any plans to reconvene or try and convince the parliament to go ahead with that, or whether this is now something that cannot be done at this stage.
Thank you very much. And could we take the gentleman in the middle, please?
Hi there, Leandros Kalisperas. Just a question about the brutality of the bail-in. Your reflections on whether a nation state would have found it within itself to impose that forced structure, and whether that in itself has also contributed to the quick recovery of Cyprus.
Thank you. And could we take the lady here, please, on the second row? And then we'll come back for another round of questions.
Anna Tsevtsoglu from the LSE. I wonder if you could name two or three factors that contributed to Cyprus's success on a political level and which, in your view, Greece has lacked during the past 7 years for its own recovery.
Thank you. So the first question about reviving privatization.
Well, we have, probably... saying that we have a mixed record would be a bit of an exaggeration because we could have done more. You are right in emphasizing that we have not been able to convince our parliament. I point out to those who are unfamiliar with our political system that we have a separation of powers, a US style of governance, so the government of the day does not enjoy an established majority in the House. That said, we are making steps. The privatization of the port of Limassol went through. The privatization of the port of Larnaca will happen probably by the end of 2017. One or two other projects are also progressing. The state lottery, the government, the state at the Troodos mountain resort. What has not been making sufficient progress is CETA, that's the telecoms. There we are finding it hard to gather sufficient parliamentary support. But we shall have another. We shall have another go. We continue to believe that privatization is a useful tool to bring in foreign investment and enhance the competitiveness of state-owned enterprises. The bail-in, that was the other question. It was a devastating development. I mean, you did mention that it facilitated the recovery of the economy. I mean, not really, in the sense that it was, it amounted to a very significant loss of wealth. So it was obviously a negative, devastating development. On the other hand, where you could be right is on the fact that had it been a bailout, it would not have been easy either. Our public debt would have been today higher than that of Greece, with everything that this would entail. If you ask me, both a bail-in and a bail-out to such an extent, to such a magnitude, should have been avoided, because it would, and it did, impose a very heavy burden on the local economy. And the only way that we could have prevented either was to take earlier preemptive action to prevent the banking sector reaching the point of no return.
Sorry, I'm not clear now then. So are you saying that in terms of the problems of the financial sector in Cyprus, the bail-in was incorrect? What should have happened?
We should have, I'm saying that the bail-in as well as the bail-out would have been very painful and hurtful for the economy anyway. It's not like, it's not as if the one of the two was benign. Both would have been very devastating for the economy, and the only way to avoid either was never to allow the situation to reach the point of no return. And the final question had to do with political circumstances. I did probably a few points, but I did mention the separation of powers, and I was referring to the shortcomings of having a separation of powers when it comes, for instance, to promoting controversial policies like privatization. On the other hand, having through a separation of power system, having a stable government, a stable executive for a full 5-year term is probably much more positive than the drawbacks of such a system. So one reason we had a full 5-year term ahead of us when we were embarking upon the effort, and this was known not only to us, but also to the people and to the markets. So that's the political stability, the systemic political stability is obviously one factor. Secondly, when we claimed ownership for the effort and for the program, we did not hide behind the Troika. I did explain, both in my introduction and just a minute ago, that we were not in agreement with the Troika on all issues. But I recently read something which was very accurate, that being in a program, being in a Troika program, is like having to cross a barren desert. You have to do it quickly. You don't have to, and you should avoid getting stuck in the middle of it. So, like it or not, we claimed ownership for the program, and we said that this is the plan, this is what we are going to do, and we did it. That again had a very positive effect on consumer and business confidence, domestically but also internationally, enabling, for instance, the re-establishment of market access for the sovereign. So a number of reasons, I think, enabled us to execute the program and to restore confidence.
Okay, thank you. Let's take another round. Could we take a gentleman here, please?
Yeah, Bernard Casey from LSE. You talked about one of the fastest rates of growth in the European area, although, of course, when you hit the bottom, you're bound to grow relatively fast. The question is where to and how. what is Cyprus growing into? Since in the past it used to be, a long way ago, an economy of potatoes and cheap holidays. It subsequently became an economy of expensive holidays and an enormous banking sector and a legal sector that was attached to that. What is Cyprus going to grow into, and how is the economy going to restructure to allow it to become once again not only a growing economy but also a relatively rich economy?
Yeah.
Can we take a few questions?
Oh yes, of course, yes.
Can we take the lady here, please?
My name is Aliki Baris. Thank you, Minister, for a very well-rounded and optimistic lecture. But alluding to that optimism, I'd like to ask, and in connection with the bail-in question, is there a possibility that that optimism would be extended to the people who have lost their life savings because of the raid on the accounts? Do you ever foresee a time when Cyprus will be in a position to perhaps reimburse these people? Thank you.
Thank you. A very precise question. Can we take the... I'm sorry, at the front here, can we take the lady here?
Thank you. Thalia Maizioglu, Hellenic Observatory. I would like to ask, since you crossed the desert very fast, you probably didn't have the problem of young people leaving in the numbers that happened in Greece in order to find a job elsewhere, immigrating. And so how did you face the expectations of young people during the crisis? Where's the fear of loss of a vibrant future as we observe in Greece or not? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I mean, the first comment, you said that an economy is bound to recover when it reaches, when it hits the bottom. I wish that were the case automatically. If that were the case, Greece would have rebounded sooner, much more strongly. So I do not think that the recovery will come automatically just like that. That would have been too easy, and I think we have seen many examples of a long protracted stagnation, and that was exactly what was predicted for Cyprus also at the time. How is the economy recovering? Well, across the sectors, actually. Tourism, shipping, business and financial services, these are traditional, well-developed industries for Cyprus. Good thing, they remained intact. They never lost their potential through the crisis. The crisis was very severe, but it had very specific root causes, an unsustainable credit expansion and an overextended banking sector, and an equally unsustainable management of the public finances. But the core industries, including those which I have mentioned, had never lost their potential, and it is those very sectors which are spearheading the recovery of the economy. Even business and financial services, which it was a sector which about which many were pessimistic, given the links to the banking sector. It has proved to be a very resilient sector, obviously relying on other core advantages beyond an overextended banking sector, especially the banking sector and the foreign business. That's changing. We do not have such a large banking sector anymore, nor do we need one. Holding excessive deposits is not necessarily beneficial for an economy. It was those very excessive deposits which fueled the unsustainable credit expansion and the property boom. That's gone, but it's not bad that it's gone, because obviously the sector is now refocusing on providing high quality services, economic substance, and that's already contributing to the recovery. And there are new sectors of economic activity which are emerging, not least the energy sector, of course, which on its own could be a game changer for the Cyprus economy. Compensation. Okay, so when a bank is in distress and is unable to recapitalize on its own means, there was only one way so far, now there are two. Either the taxpayer would pay the bill so that shareholders, bondholders, and large depositors are always safe. They never take any risk, and the taxpayer always takes the risk. That was the bailout option. The other option is the bail-in, whereby the taxpayer does not bear responsibility to save banks and to spare the cost for shareholders, bondholders, and unsecured depositors.
So is the answer to the latest?
Since 2015, across Europe, not only Cyprus, but across Europe, the bail-in is legally and bindingly the only possible way to restructure a bank. So it is not legally possible to transform a bail-in into a bailout due to the adoption of the bail-in instrument across the EU.
I suspect the lady understands that a bailout can't become a bail-in, etc. But
it would compensate.
Your answer to the very precise question is no.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, this is probably the question which I have been answering more often during the last 4 years, if we can promise a compensation. I do not think there has been a week when I was not asked to promise compensation to the people who lost their money. It's 9 billion. The annual budget of Cyprus is 6 billion. Legal constraints aside, I say that it could only become possible if we decide to cut expenditure from other items and find a legal way to shift spending from education and defense and health to compensate people who lost their money to the amount of 50% of the GDP of the country. So unless this becomes a realistic proposition, unless this is a reality, no, I will not be joining the ranks of those who offer easy promises without any substance. Last question was had to do with unemployment, young people living seeking employment elsewhere. No, we did have such we definitely had such fleeing of young graduates elsewhere during the time that unemployment was on the rise. So we had unemployment at 3% in 2008. It went up to 15% by 2013, before we even embarked on the program. So obviously, when one has such a rapid slide into a recession and such a sudden escalation of unemployment, people left, definitely. As of 2015, this trend has been reversed. And during 2016, we had an increase in employment, not only a drop in unemployment, but an increase in employment in the range of almost 3%. So with the recovery of the economy and with the gradual creation of new opportunities, people are coming back.
Okay, good, thank you. Perhaps with time just for one last round of questions. I'm sorry, so can we take four
yes,
questions?
Of course, yes.
Can we take the gentleman in the middle here first, please?
Ilias Dinenis, a former academic in Cyprus and with the Hellenic Observatory. I would like to make a factual correction, first of all. I think it's not fair to shift the responsibility for differentiating between safe and unsafe banks to the consumer when the Central Bank of Cyprus issued the infamous letter in February 2013 saying that a bail-in is unconstitutional. So I think this is a fact. Now I'll come to my question, and it has to do with productivity and employment in Cyprus. Cyprus has the highest percentage of graduates in non-graduate jobs in the European Union. And that comes from the fact that there are something like 7,000, 6,000 to 7,000 new graduates coming to the labor market, and the absorption of the economy is less than 1,000. So there is always a gap of between 5,000 and 6,000 new graduates who are employed in non-graduate jobs. As a result, this leads to low productivity and, of course, to a complete disconnect between expectations and reality in the job market. Now, the sectors that you mentioned that are growing, like tourism, does not employ graduates. The industries that employ graduates are stagnant. And are all these graduates, in your view, going to be employed in the energy sector to solve the problem?
Okay, thank you. More questions. Could we take the the lady here, please?
Hi, Eleni Gurea, I'm a journalist. I wondered what measures is the government taking to reduce the gender pay gap, which at 16% is one of the highest in Europe?
Thank you. So many of you, I don't know where to start. Can we take the lady at the, I'm sorry, the lady at the very back. It's our fitness program to get you running.
I want to ask about the privatization you're so insistent on and limiting taxation. Bearing in mind that our public services are in dire straits, particularly, say, healthcare. Cyprus has the lowest spending on healthcare compared to the rest of the European countries. So where is the money going to come from to develop the
I'm not sure if can you repeat the question?
Where's the money going to come from for development?
If there's no increase in taxation,
so keen on low taxation, etc., who's going to fund the the welfare programs and the investments in public
healthcare, development, and other public services?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Can we just take one final question, gentlemen here, please?
Thanasis Gavos, I'm a journalist, the Cyprus News Agency. I just wanted to ask something about the European Union. Does the talk from big leaders of multi-speed European Union fit in and when your vision of where the EU should be heading.
That's a talk of what?
Multi-speed Europe.
Is that what you're looking for? But the first question was where are the jobs for graduates?
Yeah. Okay, I mean, you made a comment about the central bank. Was it not the central bank who actually prepared the legislation by which the bail-in became a possibility? It was actually prepared end 2012. It was legally vetted. It was sent to the European Central Bank for comments and corrections, and it was kept in the drawer until there was a change in government and the plug was pulled off the plug. Yes, the Central Bank, yes, okay. Where would... graduate jobs, you described them, will come from. Well, let me tell you my view of what a government should do. A government should create a business-friendly economic environment. It should create conditions of macroeconomic stability. It should create a low tax environment, and it should allow the productive sectors of the economy to provide answers and to provide success stories. It's not the job of any government to decide where jobs will be created. That will inevitably lead to failure. But if, on the other hand, we create a business-friendly environment which is supportive to investment, entrepreneurship, and innovation, jobs will be created.
Can I just ask, in response to Bernard Case's question about the rebalancing of the Cyprus economy, you said that in the future the economy would be more balanced than in the past. How can that happen if the job of government is simply to create some kind of tax framework and not much more?
Well, tax is obviously one. It's obviously one element.
But how does balance happen without government intervention?
Yeah, I mean, let me give you an example, and it relates also to job creation. Who would have imagined, and who actually planned for a video gaming company to become currently one of the largest employers in Cyprus? If it was government planning, central planning, we would never have imagined that a global video gaming company could actually identify in Cyprus those advantages that would enable it to set up a base and to hire engineers and computer scientists and accountants and everything. This is what we should be creating. Conditions for business and innovation to create jobs of high-quality jobs. You mentioned the tourist sector as one which does not require graduate employment. Well, to one extent this is correct, but having a dynamic tourist industry brings in brings in revenue, and it creates opportunities for creating and expanding economic activity in other sectors also. So I wouldn't rule out tourism as a very valuable industry, one which is actually which actually has a potential to grow even more. So I would insist that it is the job of the government is to create the right conditions. Obviously, there's more to macroeconomic stability. For instance, since I am in a university and you have been a university teacher yourself, we have been investing heavily in higher education. It's a $350 million project currently, public money in the University of Cyprus. It's
still the lowest in Europe as a percentage of GDP.
I don't think so. And this is in stark contrast to what you said, that we actually have one of the highest percentages of graduates in Europe. So, that's good. That's excellent. If there is private money being investment, that's excellent. And unless we believe that everything should be paid for by the government, that would have been a different economic model than what we have.
Perhaps that leads logically to the question about what are you going to do about closing the gender pay gap?
Yes, okay. I'm not sure what we are doing, actually. There is definitely no gender pay gap in the public sector. You probably imply, and you are probably right, that there is a gender pay gap in the private sector. Again, I think that, education would be my guess. Education and ensuring that both genders are equally trained and equipped with the tools to function in a modern economy is what will ensure that the gender gap will go away. The other question was, how do we pay for public services with the low taxes? Well, the record shows that having low tax rates does not necessarily mean that you have lower public revenues, because if you have the opposite, if you have high tax rates, economic activity is dampened. It makes investing and creating a business less profitable, less attractive, so economic activity is dampened. If you have low tax rates and a business-friendly economic environment, this economic activity, the business, the investment, will generate increasing tax revenues. For instance, during the last year and during the current year, we have been reducing taxes, but we saw that the total tax revenues went up for the very reason I have been describing. We did away with a couple of taxes, but we saw, for instance, that the revenues from VAT went up by 7%, and we saw social security contributions went up by 5%. So having high tax rates is not synonymous to having sufficient public revenues. Most probably the opposite happens, and creating a low tax efficient economic environment is what will also enable the public sector within the framework of a balanced budget to conduct the welfare policy and health policy and all the other policies which are in the public domain.
The final question was about Europe and whether you're favouring a multi-speed Europe.
No, that's not the that's not actually my my proposed path for the European integration process, and that's not what I meant. That probably the European Union should do less, but it should do it better. We do have multiple speeds in the European Union in any case. I mean, not all members are member of the common currency area, but I think there is a limit. There's a limit to creating further layers and circles in the European integration process. And if we overdo it, we may in fact destabilize the cohesiveness of the union. So that's why I would rather see a more cautious approach to European integration, whereby we make positive steps. We complete the necessary, we complete the basic policies which have already been drafted, including the banking union, including the capital markets union, but ensuring that we make those steps which secure the consent of everyone, of everybody.
Thank you. I'm tempted to ask one last question, if I may.
You may.
You may have heard, but in these parts, we're talking quite a lot about Brexit.
breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
How big an impact do you think on the Cyprus economy would Brexit pose?
Yes, this is yet another question which I keep receiving, and it seems that the major concerns here have to do with tourist arrivals and even more importantly with halloumi exports. allow me to say that this provides a very, very narrow perspective on what has been a devastating development in the European integration process. And I do not think that Cyprus will have problems due to reduced halloumi exports, not least because of its high quality. but I think it's... I do not think that we should take such a narrow focus, such a narrow view. I think it has been the single most important negative development in the European unification process, and that's why I am a bit anxious about the fact that at the EU level we do not seem to have received the message. We do not seem to have received the message, and I would be very concerned if the reaction of the rest of us is to make a dash into further integration, failing to notice that the people are not behind us. This is what should be of concern to all Europeans and all EU member states, including Cyprus, how we shall be able to ensure that the European Union remains relevant and cohesive during such challenging times.
Well, thank you, Minister. I'd like to thank you for an extraordinarily clear and, if I may say, very well put set of arguments. I'm sure the audience has appreciated it. Just before I ask you to join me in thanking the Minister, can I give a small gift from the LSE, simply so that you may remember this occasion? Well, can you please join me in thanking the Minister? Thank you very much indeed. Now, you may have had quite enough of economics, or you may want more, but one of the things we can invite you to now is immediately outside there's a reception, and I understand the Minister will be happy to have conversations over wine. It's LSE wine, don't have too high expectation, but at least we can enjoy it. Thank you very much indeed.